So the topic of today is the differential geometry differential geometry of quantum phases. Okay, so let's see what is the problem that we want to solve. So as we said, we have a Hamiltonian that is a smooth operator in a set of parameters lambda. And for every lambda, we find the ground state of the Hamiltonian that will denote psi 0 lambda. And these ground states live on a manifold on which, of course, you have a chart of lambda coordinates. Very well. What is that we want to know, do is to compute our Fubini study metric, which can be approximated for small fidelity by 2, 1 minus f. Where I remind you, f is defined as the overlap between two states. Okay. So what are the two states that we have in mind? What we have in mind is that if we have some curve S that has some parametric equation lambda, so S is the parameter of the curve, then we can write the state, say 0, for some value of the parameter, and then we can write the other state, the nearby one, S plus DS, right? So these are the two states of which we compute the overlap and compute the fidelity. Okay. So how do we find the relationship between these objects and their fidelity? Well, we do this. We do the following thing. So let me write psi s plus ds as a Taylor expansion in S. Okay? So definitely, at the zero order, we have psi s. Then we would have the derivative with respect to the value with respect to lambda I times, so the derivative of psi s with respect to lambda I times the differential of lambda I. Okay? Remember, all these lambda I are function of S through here. This means that we have a parametric equation lambda 1 is lambda 1 of S, lambda n is lambda n of S. And then at the second order, we would have plus 1 half di dj Cs d lambda I lambda j plus higher terms. Yes?
Can you clarify the mapping between the lambdas to the ground states? I mean, about the genesis?
Yeah. So you know that for every lambda, you have a Hamiltonian, and every Hamiltonian can be diagonalized, and it has a ground state, and this is the ground state of this Hamiltonian.
But what about the generalcy of the ground state?
Okay, yes. So what about the generalcy? If we have a degeneracy, then we would have an additional index here, alpha. And this would be some basis in the degenerate ground space manifold. Okay? And then whatever I'm doing, it will be for one of the states. And then there are questions whether it matters what superposition we pick in that basis or not. And we will see that at least for the type of considerations that we're going to make, the degeneracy will not matter very much. But yes, so if one, depending on what you want to talk about, this could matter. But we will not get into the detail. Okay, so right now you can imagine that your ground space is either non-degenerate or that you're just picking one specific sector in your ground space. Okay, so we want to compute F squared, first of all. Okay, to compute F squared, we just do the calculation directly. So we have, so what I wrote here should be intended as cats, okay? So let me now use the cat and Brown notation properly. So we have Cs, inner product Ps plus Ds, modulus square, right? Because this is the fidelity, which means this times Ps plus Ds, inner product psi s. Okay. Okay, so let's do this calculation by using this expansion. And so you see that we get 1 plus the sum over I of two terms, the one that contains psi and the one that contains this one. Okay, so let me write it in this way. Di psi psi plus psi di psi. Then we have the terms where these two terms are multiplied together. Oh, and this is multiplied by d lambda I. Okay. Plus psi di psi, and then it's multiplied by the other one, the order of these terms, which is d. But this is a dummy index, so I need to change index. And then I have the two sums over d lambda I, d lambda j. Okay. And plus I have the two terms with the second order. Yes, so the two terms with the second order are 1 half d square ij psi psi plus psi inner product d square ij psi d lambda j. And then all the other terms that I have, like when I multiply Well, all the other terms are a higher term, so they do not compare. Okay. Okay, so let's look at that first order term, di psi psi plus psi di psi. Can you guess what is the value of this term? It's zero. So the first order term is zero. Do you know why?
Normalization?
Normalization? Yes. So can you explain?
Delta psi psi equals zero.
So as you can see, this first order term is what would happen if you differentiate psi psi. You would get b psi psi when I differentiate the bra plus psi b psi. But this is a constant, so it must be zero. So you see that the first order is zero. Very well. Okay, so the first order is not there. We have 1 plus these terms. Okay, now let me define this quantity beta is minus I here is the imaginary number psi di psi. Okay, so this is just the definition. And notice that this thing about the normalization also tells us that the psi psi is equal to minus psi de psi. Okay. So we want to use it in this term here. And remembering that beta I is defined in this way, we see that our f square is 1 plus beta I beta j that multiply the, this thing is not working, d lambda I d lambda j. Okay, so you see that beta I beta j is that product. It is because of this definition and this property. Okay, what about this last term? Okay, so you see, this is 1/2 the sum of a number plus its conjugate. So it's the real part of the term. So I can write this as the real part of psi. And now let me use this notation that you probably like, psi comma ij, which you are using in relativity. In general relativity means psi is differentiated with respect to the indexes I and j. Indexes I and j are just the directions lambda I and lambda j in our curve. Okay, so this is f square. Okay. Now, since this f square is very close to 1, we know we can expand f square and write it as 2f minus 1. Okay? It's very close to 1 because our two states are psi s and psi s plus ds. Moreover, if we take the second derivative of this guy, so we differentiate this again, we discover, you can do it as an exercise, but it's very easy, that the real part of psi, psi, comma, ij is equal to minus the real part of di psi inner product dj psi. you just redifferentiate this again and you find this. And let me define this object as, so this object, the real part of this inner product, as gamma ij. So you know that what it would compare here, okay? So this means that since f squared is 2f minus 1, then f is equal 1 plus 1f beta I beta j minus gamma ij d lambda I d lambda j. Okay. And now remember what was our goal? Was to write DFS. DFS is 2 times 1 minus f, so is equal to minus this piece. It is equal to gamma ij minus beta I beta j d lambda I d lambda j. And I will call this tensor g, capital G, ij, d lambda I, d lambda j. This object is called quantum geometric tensor. Very well. So we have associated to our infinitesimal distance in our in the Hilbert space for a continuous family of states a tensor that is a complex tensor. It's made of complex numbers. Okay? Now, the interesting thing are both the imaginary part of Gij that we call Fij, and the real part of Gij, which we'll call just small gij. So the imaginary part is what is called adiabatic curvature. So every time you move a state adiabatically in the Hilbert space and you want to compute the holonomy of this path, you need a connection, and this object is the connection that you look for. And then there is another object that is the real part. The real part is an actual metric tensor. This is a Riemannian metric tensor, so that this object endows our space of states that depend on lambda with a Riemannian structure. So everything you know from differential geometry, curvature, Ricci tensor, everything can be computed from this. Of course, in order to know what is Jj, you have to compute these objects, right? Gamma ij, beta I, and beta j, meaning the overlaps between the derivative of the state, or the overlaps between two derivatives of the state. So before I go ahead, any questions about this? I would really like to have this one go over that. Yes. Yes?
Can you clarify the intuition of the imaginary part again?
The imaginary part is the berry face, is the connection that defines the holonomy by which you can compute the berry face. And right now we don't have time to discuss that part. We will focus on the real part, on the Riemannian metric tensor. It is, in fact, they're both interesting because also this part can spot to the quantum phase transitions, but this one has more properties, is a more full-fledged object. And actually, I do not know if people have used this connection in the case of ground states of many-body Hamiltonians to define geodetic equations and things like that. They have with this one, because you can do it with both, right? These are two independent structures. Okay. So far, all we have used about our psis, about these objects that we are differentiating, is that you can differentiate them, right? That they depend on these parameters, lambda 1, lambda n. But nowhere here, so far, we have used the fact that these are the ground states of some many-body Hamiltonian. Okay? So all I've done until now is you can define it, it's all true for every continuous family of states psi. You can define it, you know, you can define it formally. You can take a set of states, you can get have a basis, and you make the coefficients of this basis that depend on the parameters lambda 1, lambda n, and there you go. Then you can define a metric tensor. Okay? But now, you know, we don't want to do something so formal, right? We actually want this psi zero of lambda be the ground states of a Hamiltonian. Okay. So we have a Hamiltonian that depends on some parameter, lambda, and then we get all the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian, in particular the ground state. But we actually need all the eigenstates. What we will do is the following. Consider a perturbation of this Hamiltonian. So the perturbation of this Hamiltonian is some delta H that is just the difference between H of lambda plus a little increment of our parameter minus the original one. And then we want to write the ground state of this Hamiltonian, okay, of the perturbed Hamiltonian. So you know that you can write any eigenstate of the perturbed Hamiltonian, knowing the ground state of the original Hamiltonian, using perturbation theory. And how does perturbation theory work? Well, you have your state for the unperturbed Hamiltonian, plus, at the first order, you have the sum over all the other eigenstates. So n is the label of the eigenstates. So all the eigenstates that are not the ground state of the original eigenstate times a coefficient. And this coefficient has to do with the perturbation. It's, in fact, how the perturbation couples your ground state unperturbed with your excited state unperturbed over the gap between the state that you are perturbing, that is the ground state, and the n excited state. So this is perturbation theory, as you know from quantum mechanics. Well, this is the first order, and then you have other orders, orders delta h squared. Okay, so now this is interesting because you know how to relate a small increment of the state using perturbation theory. Now, what happens if I take this state to the other side and I divide it by delta lambda? Then I get the derivative of the state. And you know that this thing goes away. So this term is actually what we need. And it becomes exact. So this would be delta, d psi lambda. Well, in order to compute the geometric tensor, the Riemannian metric tensor, well, then you need to do these overlaps and put things together. And how to do it in detail is the topic of the next tutorial. So you pretty much have to, this is like a deep psi. Okay? So this is the main ingredient. So you just need to put the things together. And the result is that g, let me use the indexes mu nu, is equal to the real part. Okay, so you can imagine that you have things that are quadratic, right? Because I'm doing overlaps of terms like this. So what we will have is the sum over all the eigenstates that are not the ground state. And here I will have the gap with the ground state squared. Let me write it explicitly. The energy of the nth eigenstate minus the energy of the ground state, they both depend on lambda squared. And here you have the ground state times the derivative of h with respect to mu, psi n lambda, and then again psi n lambda, the derivative with respect to nu, psi 0, the real part of this is g mu nu. Okay, so now our physics entered in here. Before, psi of lambda was just some generic family of states to the parameters with the parameters lambda, but now this is the Riemannian tensor that is induced by the Hamiltonian by looking at how the ground state changes when I change lambda. Very well. So let us apply this result to the Hamiltonian that we know, the quantum XY Hamiltonian. So h can be written like minus the sum over all the spins on 1 plus gamma over 2 sigma xi plus 1 plus 1 minus gamma over 2 sigma y I plus 1 plus lambda sigma z I. So this is our Hamiltonian. And we know that the ground state can be written as a tensor product on the modes k. right, after we diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the k-modes. So it's a tensor product over all the k's of the superposition of two states. The vacuum for every k, so this means that for every mode k, we are in the vacuum, with some coefficient that we called cosine theta k over 2, plus I sine theta k over 2, the state in which we have produced one fermion with momentum k and one fermion with momentum minus k. So this is the ground state in the sector of parity 1, where we only have an even number of fermions. And who are these theta k? So remember that the energy spectrum delta k, maybe I called it lambda k in a previous lecture, is equal to the square root of two terms, epsilon k squared plus delta k squared. And delta k was gamma sine k. And theta k is just epsilon k over lambda k. So this is the definition of theta k. Let me see if I want to say something else here. OK. So we want to compute this object for this set of states. And well, since we have a very compact expression of omega, we do not need to go through this formula. We can just use our definitions in terms of the beta and of the gammas. Since our theta depend on the parameters gamma and lambda, then we can just use this expression to compute our overlaps. In particular, the overlap between two ground states for two different values of our parameter lambda. Now, by lambda here, I don't mean just this lambda here. I mean the vector lambda and gamma. One can show, and also this is part of the tutorial, but you basically just have to do the overlap between these two, between this state for a certain value of theta and the same state for another value of theta. Well, it's not surprisingly the product of all the k's of something that contains the two thetas. And this indeed the cosine of theta bar k minus theta k over 2. So knowing this ingredient and using our definition of beta and gamma, one shows that g mu nu is equal to 1/4 the sum over all the k's of d theta k, d theta k, d lambda mu, d lambda nu. Okay? So our geometric tensor is given by differentiating our angles theta between in the two different directions, and then summing over all the angles theta that are labeled by k. Now, this sum is not very easy to do unless we go in the thermodynamic limit. In the thermodynamic limit, the sum over k becomes, and this is a trick that is used a lot in many body theory, L over 2 pi, L here is the length of the chain, the integral between 0 and pi in dx. So in the thermodynamic limit, you have the integral of these quantities. The integral can be done. And so direct calculations, you do the integral, leads to, so let me write to the expression of g mu nu for lambda, this lambda, the magnetic field, smaller than 1. We find the following matrix, g mu nu is equal n, this is the number of spins, over 16 absolute value of gamma. And then we have a 2 by 2 matrix, right? Because mu and nu are indices that take the two values, gamma and lambda. These are our parameters. These are our directions in the parameter space. And they are 1 over 1 minus lambda square, 1 over 1 plus absolute value of gamma all square, 0, 0. Let me pull this up. So that is our g mu nu. As you can see, g mu nu is proportional to n always in every point of the parameter space. So in the thermodynamic limit, g mu nu always diverges. This has nothing to do with quantum phase transitions. It's just a manifestation of the fact that when we go in the thermodynamic limit, you remember all states are orthogonal. It's the thing that we said in the first lecture. So the quantity that we really care about is the rescaled tensor g mu nu over n. This is what we look at. So in general, we want to look at this quantity. We want to know when this diverges. In this case, instead of looking at g mu nu, we can look just at a simpler object that is the scalar curvature, sorry, the Ricci scalar, which is the contraction of the Ricci tensor, and R as the following values, when lambda is smaller than 1, we get minus 16 over n, 1 plus gamma over gamma. And when lambda is greater than 1, 16 over n, absolute value of lambda plus lambda squared plus gamma squared minus 1. Over lambda squared plus gamma squared minus 1. And you see that as you approach the line lambda equal 1 from the left and from the right, this object has a discontinuity. The two limits are not the same. So R is discontinuous for lambda equal plus and minus 1. Well, and this is exactly what we expect, because we know that the XY model has a critical line at lambda, this is gamma, lambda equal plus 1 and lambda equal minus 1. So these green lines are critical lines, and also at gamma equal 0 between lambda is equal plus 1 and lambda is equal minus 1. So we have spotted in the Ricci scalar these two lines. That gamma equals 0 also diverges, you can see it directly from the expression of G mu. But you need lambda to be greater than 1%. So as you can see, we can spot the phase transitions that we were ascribing to the vanishing of the gap. We are ascribing them now to the divergence in the Riemannian geometric tensor. As you can see here, the gap does play a role. If this goes to zero, this thing might diverge. However, as you can see, now we have a much finer explanation because, well, if this goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit for n equal 1, the first excited state, well, not necessarily the whole thing diverges. It might diverge. But that depends on how fast this thing behaves. If they go to zero faster than this, then it might converge. So you see, now we have a better way of understanding quantum phase transitions because we can indeed study systems, like some systems with disorder, in which, in spite of not being there a gap, still there are no critical phenomena. There are things called mobility gaps. And they come from the fact that the Hamiltonian does not couple, the variation of the Hamiltonian does not couple different states. So in other words, this term is small. So what can we conclude only knowing the gap? Is this all junk? There is nothing that we can say at all. Well, this theory tells us something that people have used all along, a bit like, you know, a folk theorem. But actually, equipped with this knowledge, now we can show the following thing is that if there is a gap, then there are no quantum phase transitions. So the closure of the gap is a necessary condition for having a quantum phase transition. So how do we do that? Okay, now we do something a bit abstract, okay? As if this was very concrete. More abstract. But then eventually becomes something very concrete. Okay, so think of G mu nu as a matrix that acts on some vector space. Okay? So now forget for a second that what is inside G mu nu, what mu and nu really mean. Now these are two indices. So this is a matrix. So there is a vector space on which it acts. Okay? So on this vector space, you have vectors, a basis of vectors in mu, in which this has these matrix elements, or any other basis for this tensor. Okay. Now, let this I label the eigenstates of G mu nu. Okay? So among all these vectors in the Hilbert space, in this vector space, there are some vectors that are the eigenstates of this matrix. These are not quantum states, they're just the eigenvector of this abstract matrix. Of this, let me call phi the eigenvector corresponding to the maximum eigenvalue. Okay, so this is a symmetric matrix. It will be diagonalized. It has eigenvalues and eigenvectors. One of these eigenvalues is the max. And this is the eigenvector corresponding to this maximum eigenvalue. Well, then, this must be, well, this is just the eigenvalue, right? Must be greater than any matrix element. Okay, so it's something in linear algebra. Okay. Now, in this vector space, let the components of this vector of maximum eigenvalue let me call this the components of this vector phi mu. Okay? And let me define this delta H. Now I define it. It's just the sum of these numbers and these numbers. Yeah.
Since when does the G have an operator?
Huh?
Since when is G an operator?
G is a matrix, right?
A matrix on the parameter space.
So, yes. So a matrix is a linear operator.
On the parameter, not on the Hilbert space.
Not on the Hilbert space. So these are the vectors in this vector space on which G mu is a matrix. And phi is the eigenvector of maximum eigenvalue of this matrix. And these are its components.
So this cat is a 2x2, is a two quantum?
It's not quantum.
Ah, no, sorry. In the XY model, this phi cat is a 2-column.
Yes, yes. Now let delta H be, okay. You see, now you have this object here. This object are the components of H in this basis of the mu h, and the same for this. So I can define this object. Okay, in this vector space, this is a scalar. All right. In fact, I could use this notation. In this vector space, this is like the inner product of dh times phi. In this vector space. Okay. So using this and this, we can write that G mu nu is smaller than the sum over all the eigenstates above the ground state. This is the gap squared. So far, I didn't do anything yet. And then we have psi zero delta mu, right? But if I use this number delta H, this is true. And now I have a majorization. Remember that here in G mu nu, I have this and the complex conjugate. But here I have a mu and nu, but hey, in delta H I've summed over all the mu's. In a way that because I am evaluating it in the vector of greatest eigenvalue, this holds true, and therefore I have this majorization. This minus. delta to the minus 2. Okay. Now I can do a very easy majorization by taking of all these gaps, this is the gap with the n excited state, I take the gap with the first excited state. So 1 over this gap square is a greater number, right? Let me just call it epsilon 1 to the minus 2. And then I have the sum over all the n's greater than 0 of just this guy. Very good. OK, so as you can see, here I have the sum over all the n's but 0. Right? It was necessary to be like that because if I had also the n equals 0, everything would diverge, right? Perturbation theory wouldn't work. But now that we have done all our majorizations, the gap came out, right? So we don't care about the gap anymore. So I can just obtain an identity by summing over all the n's and then taking out the term that contains n equals 0. Do you agree? I am just summing and subtracting the same term, that is this one. By summing this term, here instead of having n greater than 0, I have all the n's because I was just missing the 0 term. And then I subtract. Very well. OK, so now notice that because this is the module square, I can open it up again. And I would have psi n delta h psi 0. Do you agree? But the sum over all the n's of this is the resolution of the identity. It's the identity. So I can take out this sum and these guys here. And I'm left with delta h square in psi 0. Oh, so we know, we just found something, that the matrix elements of my Riemannian tensor are upper bounded by 1 over the inverse square, 1 over the square gap, times the fluctuations of how sensible is my Hamiltonian, right? Because this is the expectation value in the ground state of delta h square, minus the expectation value in my ground state of delta h squared. We are almost done. So first of all, it's very interesting that we can upper bound g mu nu with the fluctuations. Because now we could say something, you know, if the fluctuations do not diverge, then g mu nu is bounded. But we can say more. So first of all, let's simplify. OK, so first of all, assume that our Hamiltonian, our variation of the Hamiltonian, is local. So when we change the Hamiltonian, we change locally some terms in the Hamiltonian. So this means that we can write it as the sum over some local operators that have support on some degrees of freedom labeled by J. So if you do that, our majorization becomes G mu nu is upper bounded by, again, this gap. And then we have the sum over I and J of what? In the ground state, this expectation value is in the ground state. Let me just write it as an expectation value. as you can see, it's upper bounded now by the connected correlation functions of our perturbations. Now, to make our life a bit easier, let's assume with not much, we actually without much loss of generality, that our system is isotropic, is rotational invariant. So that the sum over I and j can be replaced by the volume, L to the d, times the sum over r, just the distance from some given point that we label by the origin of our system. This is a trick that we have already used in 1D. This is in any spatial dimensions d. Then this becomes upper bounded again by the inverse square gap, LD, and then the sum over R of this connected correlation function. This is Cij. When they depend only on R, we call them Cr. Okay. And we are interested in this quantity that is g mu nu over L to the d. Remember, we have to normalize with n the number of degrees of freedom that is like the volume is L to the d. So this is the object that we want to know if it is bound. Now, here we have the gap. And now we have the sum over all the correlation functions. Now, we have said many times that if there is a gap, there is a finite correlation length. It's definitely true in the Ising model, right? It is, in fact, always true. We need to prove it, but for the time being, let's just accept it. This is E1. So, let's assume that the gap is not closing. Then there is a finite correlation length, okay? So epsilon 1 different from 0, psi finite. The sum of the correlation functions converges. So this is upper bounded by this. But this is non-zero. Sorry, epsilon 1 is non-zero, so epsilon 1 to the minus 2 is a finite number. This is a finite number. And therefore, this does not blow up. And so we have proven that statement over there. If there is a gap, no quantum phase transitions. So having a gap is a necessary condition for a quantum phase transition. It's necessary for this object to blow up that the gap is closing. But as we commented earlier, it's not sufficient. If these numerators behave in some specific way, even if the gap closes, you might not have a quantum phase. Okay, so to summarize what we have done, we have seen that we can endow a manifold of states that are parameterized by continuous parameter with a Riemannian structure that is a Riemannian metric tensor. When this family of states that are continuous are obtained by a Hamiltonian as the ground states of that Hamiltonian, this metric tensor can be expressed in this way. And we define a quantum phase transition at points in the parameter space where the metric tensor that tells us how different are two nearby states diverges. Diverges once you have we have it normalized by the volume, okay? So that is what we define as a quantum phase transition. So this is what is a dramatic change in the state, that its metric diverges. It's exactly what we want. And using this knowledge, we have seen that we can actually upper bound the matrix elements of the geometric tensor, of the Riemannian tensor, by correlation functions. And if there is a gap, correlation functions have to, the sum of correlation functions converges, and therefore there is no blow up. So the only thing that I have not shown you is the fact that indeed, so this part, we know it's true for the model that we've studied, but now we are being general. So one of our goals in the next lectures will show that indeed, finite correlation length comes from having a non-vanishing gap with the first excited state, not the other way around. You might have an infinitesimal gap and still have a finite correlation length. But definitely, if you have a finite gap, correlation length is finite. And you, what does it mean? That you do not have long-range fluctuations. And long-range fluctuations can be responsible for the blowing up of our notion of distance in the space of quantum states. Okay, so starting from tomorrow, we will try to understand this fact and to understand this fact, we need a technical result that is called the Lieb-Robinson bounds that we'll explain tomorrow, and which apparently has nothing to do with all of this, but it is in fact a statement about the local properties of quantum mechanics, and we'll see more about that tomorrow.